The Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Interactive Brokers charges U.S. dollar margin loan rates from 0.75 to 1.59%. Of course, rates are subject to change. Learn more at ibkr.com/compare.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And there it was, the last major option expiration of the year. The horses are turning the corner, coming down the stretch as Congress is pushing until the 11th hour. News from the Fed, and we have listener questions to be answered. Our guest today is author and certified financial planner Veronica Karas. All this and much more on episode number 693 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a very happy holiday to you. It's that time of year. You know, we're winding down, getting ready for what's ahead. And usually, well, not this year maybe, but usually spending time with families and friends and parties and get-togethers and gatherings and gift-giving and present exchanges and kind of a bit anticlimactic this year as the big parties and New Year's happenings are, well, clamped down or restricted. It's getting so old for all of us, isn't it? Hopefully this whole vaccine thing, which we had more news, by the way, over the weekend, is going to be the thing that does it, getting us back to where we want to be. Even though I live in Florida, where it seems like anything goes, right? Our governor's like, we're not closing no matter what. Seems like not much is happening this year either. Anyway, with that, I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I'd like to invite you all that are listening today and learning and getting information and education to continue on becoming and on your path towards being a disciplined investor. That's what it's all about. That's what we're here for. I mean, we cover a lot of ground each and every week. We discuss all sorts of areas, hopefully providing you a solid base. That's the whole point here, right? For your financial education and maybe have some fun along the way doing it, of course. But the whole idea is that we have the opportunity each week to come together and have an uncluttered discussion that is exempt from, we'll call it strange opinion, but rather some solid fundamentals, right, of finance. And talk about that in a way that is understandable and that hopefully is honestly motivational to get you to making sure that you are taking this very seriously, because it's all about the opportunity for you to have financial security in the future. Now, we do have a few listener questions, and I'll mention that if you do want to ask a question, because we had also our Monday pop-up Q&A webinar that was only supposed to last for a couple of weeks or so. And a lot of people asked their questions there. It ended up being months because the interest was so high. But, you know, it's really amazing how great the interest was and how many people each and every week. I mean, a full room every single week on Mondays. But all things must come to an end. That was scheduled to be temporary. We extended it a lot longer than was anticipated due to scheduling and all that. You know, we made it happen during the darkest days of the pandemic when things were really out of control, and decided, you know what, since it's so popular, we'll continue doing it for a while. But we're going to be ending that at the end of this year. So we'll come up with something new, something to substitute. We have a few things in the works right now. But in the future, yes, come along and spend the next couple of Mondays with us. At 4:30, you can find the information over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. To the right, in the right-hand sidebar, there's a registration area. But more so, if you do have a question, which again, we're going to get to today, a variety of them that have been sent in, go over to the same site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and there's a little button that says Ask Andrew, and you'll get the information right there. So all that aside, let's talk about what's going on, because it's been a crazy weekend and week of announcements, of excitement between, yeah, some of the mergers and the Bitcoin move and all that. But how about at the close of the markets on Friday, we got two pieces of news that will undoubtedly be market moving coming into next week. And number one was, of course, the Moderna vaccine. We see that that is a very similar vaccine, the way it works, to the Pfizer vaccine. Well, we got FDA approval a couple of steps away to go for emergency use authorization to have that distributed as well. And then the Fed comes out with their stress tests and says, hey, you know what? Things are pretty good. So good that banks up to a limit can start doing buybacks and dividends, payments out and, doing their thing again. And after the close on Friday, which was a down day, a little profit taking with options expiration and all, and going into the end of the year as people are doing some of their tax loss harvesting, concerned about the fact that where is stimulus? How is this going to play out? We're talking about a government shutdown. So Friday was kind of not a great day for markets. But after the close, banks went straight up. I mean, we saw a move about 5%, 4% for Bank of America, JP Morgan, and all the major players that passed, quote unquote, passed the stress tests, which is really fascinating that in a time where we have to have ultra low emergency level rates, at a time that we have to have $120 billion per month of quantitative easing, at a time that we have no way to get to our inflation goals, it looks like we have a significant amount of unemployment and real problems in the economy. Plus, banks have loan loss reserves they put aside in the multiple billions of dollars that now all of a sudden banks can start doing their buybacks again. I don't exactly know how that's going to help the economy and why the Fed is going down this path at this time where we have the most severe outbreaks happening here and around the world historically from what we've seen. And even though, yes, there is this vaccine that should solve a lot of these problems, little weird that they decided, unless it's just all about a Christmas present for the banks, to allow for share buybacks at this time and couldn't wait to see how things are going to play out into the start of 2021. Weird. But just one more of those times that there is a desire for the Fed to simply, you know, goose things. So let's take a look at the week and how it was, and that bid that we've been talking about on the heels, or on the, not the heels, on the carrot of the fact that that we're going to have low rates till 2023. We're going to see that the stimulus deal, about $900 billion, will be approved soon. Is kind of keeping things alive and well. I mean, yeah, Congress is going to take this stimulus down to the wire as far as they need to go, a little shutdown for a few days possible. But I think really we're going to get something. I don't think it's unreasonable to believe that we're going to get some kind of stimulus before Christmas. And I mean, we have to, right? I mean, there's some sticking points as now some of the Republicans want to curtail and, in fact, permanently close off the ability for the Fed to exercise their buying and underlying help for state and municipalities. They're talking about closing down permanently the Main Street lending program for good. I mean, forever. Never, ever being able to do it again by law, by legislative action. And that's not sitting really well with the Democrats, as they want to have the ability to, hey, you know what? If we need to restart this because something goes screwy, well, we want to have all options available to us. So even if they do cut this out, the fact is they'll call it something else, come up with it in a different manner, and they'll figure out, the lawyers will figure out some way around this. I am pretty certain about this. So that's right now what's happening, and probably, again, before Christmas, I would expect, because we have this cliff, unemployment compensation that is going to end for a lot of people that was underwritten by the federal government. That's going to end. And that's going to end right after Christmas. So with that, I think there's going to be something that Congress doesn't, again, you have to remember about Congress. They're gonna bitch and moan. They're going to fight. They're going to kick and scream. But in the end, they're just going to get things done because they need to make it look good for their resumes. And everything's all about eventual reelection. Now, coming into next week, we had a pretty short trading week over the next couple of weeks. Obviously, a Christmas on a Friday, which closes markets, half day on Thursday. And usually at this time of year, we start talking about how, you know, hey, maybe it's going to be, you know, traders off the desk on vacation due to the holiday. But I don't know if that's necessarily going to be the case this year. So, you know, it probably will be significant volume, especially with the year that we had, especially because we have this massive change of the components of the S&P 500, this big rebalancing that's going to be going on and buying into due to the Tesla in to the move into the S&P 500. So a lot of things happening with that. One of the big things last week, though, was it had to be the FOMC meeting. And just to quickly talk about that, you know, when I listened to that, I was like, man, this guy is talking out of both sides of his face here. I mean, kind of a forked tongue in a way. Powell's talking about this projecting that we have this really good economic recovery and that GDP is going to be above 4% next week, next year. And at the same time, which is kind of crazy, at the same time, he's talking about needing to keep interest rates down at emergency, historically low levels until 2023. It kind of makes me laugh. It's got to make you laugh how they talk about this, right? We have no inflation on the horizon. And the problem is that the Fed and other powers out there, like the Japanese central bank and everybody, they're trying to convince us that their efforts in what they can use, the tools that are available to them, can actually guide inflation in the future. In other words, they believe that the things that they're doing have a severe and significant and a powerful impact on the direction of inflation, moving it back to the level that they want it to be. Come on. I mean, if that is not the most ridiculous thing that you've ever heard. Yeah, I think there's going to be inflation in the future, but the reason that we're suggesting that we're going to see some of this is not necessarily specifically due to the Fed. Not alone. Because I think it's a combination of this low interest rate environment and massive, I mean massive, fiscal stimulus, direct payments to people in the form of unemployment benefits, direct checks, loans, all the programs are pushing lots and lots of money into the system. In fact, when you look at the M1 chart, this is the M1 basically is the amount of money that's in the system. So I got a definition because I want you to understand this. This is the St. Louis Fed's definition of M1. Let me grab this here. So M1 includes funds that are readily available and accessible for spending. It consists of currency outside the U.S. Treasury, the Federal Reserve Banks, and the vaults of depository institutions. It includes traveler's checks and non-bank issuers. Do we even have traveler's checks anymore? I don't know. We used to have that a lot, right? You just travel and you didn't want to get things stolen, you got traveler's checks. If you're young enough not to remember those days, you should check those out. Then it also includes demand deposits and checkable deposits, which consist of primarily negotiable orders of withdrawal or NOW accounts of depository institutions and credit unions, which have shared draft accounts. Now, in other words, basically, it's readily accessible cash. It's money that is readily available for spending, or really what this we could say is also investing. So now when you look at this M1 chart since November, what we've seen is it's unquestionable. It's a parabolic move higher. I mean, just this ramp, this vertical move from November. Historically, it's been growing over the years, and we have more money in the system due to the, you know, they keep on issuing more money and spending more money and putting more money in the system through a debasement by the Fed and direct payments by the government, right? The U.S. government. So when you add that together, it really starts to do stuff, right? Where is all this coming from? Well, it's the stimulus. Now, when you look at that chart, you have to believe and just mentally kind of envision this, that this has a high correlation to the moves in equity markets since November. It's pretty incredible. It's not exact, but you have to believe that this ramp that we saw that started in November in the M1 that was available, the money in the system, has had a significant impact on the investable assets that are being put to work on a regular basis in the markets. Since January, the increase in the M1 money supply was, listen to this, $2.5 trillion. That's the most significant amount in a period of time ever that I've ever seen. And most of that, a chunk of that, started out coming in throughout the beginning of the year like normal. March, of course, April, when they started to pump a lot of money through printing and quantitative easing and initiated that program as well as the Stimulus and CARES Act. And then November just started going haywire again to the upside. So part of the money probably was shoved into the markets from all this. And if you're wondering what happened in November, hey, why did the markets go up in November? It wasn't like, you know, earnings. It wasn't anything else. It was this incredible push of money into the M1 supply by the powers that be that increased the amount of money available for spending, which helped the economy, of course, but also really provided for that trickle down that we've seen into markets. So that stimulus combination is what I'm talking about when I speak about inflation. The whole idea of where are we going? Is there going to be inflation? The Fed's full of crap. They can't do it on their own. But when you start to see the velocity of money really start to move higher like we've seen due to the fact of the incredibly low interest rates where you can borrow tons of money and the flush of actual money into the system and liquidity that it created, that is inflationary. Now, there are a lot of deflationary or disinflationary headwinds that are going on as well, like the unemployment situation. But we start cleaning all that up with a vaccine and back to work and all that. Things could get pretty hairy towards the end of maybe third quarter of this year or so, maybe a little bit further on, in the inflation area, especially if the Fed says they're going to continue and keep interest rates at a very low level for a long period of time. So I think that answers a lot of questions about what happened, and we'll kind of keep on looking at what are the clues for what's going to move forward, you know, what's going to happen in the future. I want to get to our guest, and I think is a good time to think about some planning right now. Again, we've talked about this into the end of the year, specifically financial planning. But before we do that, I want to talk to all the financial advisors that are listening right now and that are tuned in on a regular basis, because I know there's a lot of you. And the question I want to ask you is, have you been thinking about or considering looking to add or switch custodians for your clients? I mean, maybe going independent. So Interactive Brokers provides low-cost trading and turnkey custody solutions for any size firm. So whether you're kind of just starting out with a few clients, or maybe you're expanding into a different area, or thinking about, you know what, I really want good trading, well, you could trade globally from a single integrated master account with no ticket charges, no custody fees, no minimums, and no tech platform or even reporting fees. I mean, there's incredible amount of benefits that you get, bells and whistles, if you will, pretty much for free. Plus, Interactive Brokers has no advisory team or prop trading group to compete with you for your clients. That's important. So Think about switching to another solution. You can switch the custodial solutions that work for you at IBKR/RIA. Again, something to consider. At least take a look at it. IBKR.com/RIA. Let's take a little walk down the financial planning path and get to our guest, Veronica, and see what she has to say. And our guest today is Veronica Karas. She is a certified financial planner and has been involved in the financial industry for over 15 years and began her career and in the life insurance area, then moved into investment research before she started working in the opportunity and helping people with what her passion is, which is financial planning. She has some books out, which is Serious Money Matters. The latest is Money Matters, Everything You Should Have Learned in School But Didn't. And she's a hot yoga instructor, plus a Long Island girl. So here's the deal, Veronica. We have a lot in common, you and I.
Yes, yes, we do.
So I'm
thank you for having me.
You're welcome. It's great to have you. I'm a Long Island boy from Comac. I started in the insurance business a few years before you, of course. And then I moved into investment management, financial planning. I'm a certified financial planner and an author. The difference, I can't do that hot yoga stuff.
It's only good for certain people. It's not for everyone.
Yeah, I've tried yoga one time and the yoga instructor's like, okay, Andrew, you need to like stretch and turn. We were sitting on the ground. Turn your torso. Like, I'm like, what do you mean? I'm all the way around. They're like, you haven't even moved. I'm like, I'm so stretched. I can't even. They're like, you haven't moved. Your arms are over there, but your entire body is straight. I'm like, all right, that's the end of this. The end of this.
Well, I appreciate that the share on that experience. And I'll say that some of my best ideas for creative financial planning strategies have also come during teaching hot yoga classes.
Oh,
there's
right?
something about moving your physical body that taps into a different part of your brain.
Oh.
So if you need incentive to try it again, that's my push for you.
That's the push, huh? I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems a little bit hard, but I'll do it. Let's talk a little bit about finance. And I want to talk to you about the idea of kind of not the usual investments that we always talk about, but really about the idea of financial planning, specifically related to different age people and different kind of people in different times of their life. And in particular, let's start with, maybe it's not the beginning, but you know, a lot of people get married and they have a lot of questions about finances, right? And then obviously as they go through life, the two major things they fight over is kids and money.
Yep.
So
yeah,
there's that kind of moment where you're married or somewhere along the line when you're dating or somewhere in the line when you're engaged that you have to think about, okay, what am I going to do with my money? Am I going to merge it with somebody else? Am I going to keep mine separate? What's kind of like the most appropriate way to think about this?
Yeah, so I would say just as a relationship has stages, you want to start having, or most people should start having discussions around money and financial obligations specifically as early on as possible, which most people like to avoid like it's the plague. Mm. And so I often have clients come to me and they're like, so we've never talked about money, but I just found out, you know, we just got engaged and I found out, you know, half of the income that, you know, my fiance has actually goes to supporting his grandmother in her long-term care facility. And like, I don't want to pay for that. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's a million things like that, right? Prior marriages and alimony and child support. And some of the things are more obvious and others aren't. And I would say there are, and one of my books, my second book actually walks you through this. It's called Money Matters, Merging Lives, Merging Finances, sort of like just general conversations you should have as you're developing the stages of your relationship. So as you start to get closer, just spend more time together, maybe even moving in together. Those are the times not just to have conversations around current money situations, but philosophy around money. You know, if you're a big saver and the person you're marrying is a huge spender, that's an easy, you know, sort of thing to think, okay, these are potential issues that we may run into the future. Let's come to a consensus now before it becomes an issue.
Now, how do you even broach the subject though? Because I know that a lot of people are really concerned about that, right? The whole idea of, oh, I don't want to talk about money and definitely not going to talk about prenups and certain things because that could just break the whole deal. How do you ease into that?
Yeah, I would say start the conversation softly, depending on where you are in your relationship. So, you know, things like, what do you imagine? You know, it's all related around goals. So like, what are your goals in the next 5 to 10 years, right? These are kind of conversations you want to have with whoever you're developing a relationship with anyway. And then it's sort of getting into the, what are the resources that you have or are planning to have or habits you have that are going to get you towards those goals? So common conversations I'll have is, you know, people come, younger clients come to me and they'll say, you know, we're really looking to buy an apartment together. I'm like, great. What else do you have going on? Is there credit card debt? Is there student loan debt? What prevents you from already having that apartment that you want to buy, or what has prevented? Is it just the number of earning years, or is it something else that's eating away at your cash flow? And it's just having those conversations really matter-of-factly without judgment that I think makes them successful and doesn't ruin your relationship.
So this is probably not the thing you want to start off the conversation with on a first date.
No, but I would say if you're on your like 20th date, it might be good to know if, you know, your significant other has student loans that they're going to pay, which is assuming a super common one, you know, student loans they'll be paying for the next 25 years. If you're on your 20th date, it's pretty important to know that, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, because what happens is that, you know, you have two people that are very compatible in life, but they, like you said, they may be totally different in terms of not only their spending habits, but on their savings habits. And not only on their savings habits, but what about risk? That's a big issue, right? You know, how much risk are they willing to take? How do you deal with that? Because I get stuff all the time, by the way. You know, I have one party is kind of aggressive and the other is very conservative. And they're like, okay, well, if you go right down the middle, that's too aggressive for the one and that's too conservative for the other.
Yeah, so definitely. And I think a lot of this actually comes down to understanding the blueprint of the significant other, right? So everybody has an ingrained like sort of money mindset blueprint that can be taught to us from, you know, our family, our relationships, our growing up. You know, like you kind of hear, depends on what you heard throughout your life. If your family was on the side of, you know, money doesn't grow on trees, or, you know, you have to pick up every penny on the street, you might develop certain, you know, more conservative behaviors. If you were raised really differently and, you know, you never wanted for anything and anything you ever asked for, your parents gave you, money was no object and, you know, everything just aligned favorably for you, then you might feel really different, right? And so it also, you know, I've seen clients with beliefs like money is the root of all evil, or more money, more problems. You know, we all hear these things and you internalize them as you're growing up. So I think some of those things are worked through just by coming to a place of understanding where your significant other is coming from. When it comes to risk, there's always the, well, how do we find the happy balance? You know, individual retirement accounts, for instance, will always be individualized. So maybe you can be more risky if you're more, if you're less conservative than your partner in your IRA or your 401k, but joint assets would come to that, you know, kind of moderate place where both people can be somewhat happy.
And then what happens if, let's say, one person's IRA does a lot better because they're really aggressive, let's say, or maybe the opposite is true. One was more conservative, the markets didn't do well. How do you deal with that in the future? Now, all of a sudden, whether it's the IRA or separate accounts that, you know, and let's just use the example, everybody starts out with the same amount of money. All of a sudden, it's lopsided. Does the other person say, well, you know what? We discussed this and, you know, I'm going to get the Lambo and, you know, you could drive the Toyota Corolla. That's the choice you made. Is that, I mean, that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. But I, you know, I always tell clients to keep in mind that all money earned is joint money, right? During your marriage. So if you're saving it, whether you pick one strategy or another, everyone is kind of sort of enrolled in the benefit and the consequences of whatever that strategy is. So in that example, in your example, if that couple got divorced, the client who made a lot more in their IRA because they chose to be more aggressive or more conservative, depending on some timing there, they would still have to split their IRA.
Right. So what about the what about the situation where now we have a similar circumstance that we laid out here, where you have two people that maybe have obviously it's really easy if everybody has the exact goals and all that. So let's, you know, we're not really going to talk about that because there's nothing to talk about. But what about those people who are not married, never going to be married for one reason or another, whatever the reason is, whether it's because it's a second marriage or a third marriage, or whether it's because they just choose to do so, or whether who knows what the reason is, right? What kind of things can they do to...
They could not combine their finances.
Right.
It gets really complicated when you have second, third marriages, or if you have radically different goals, different lifestyles. There's a point where it becomes really, it doesn't make sense to combine finances. And in fact, you're better off, especially if you're not getting married, because on paper, your income is not joint income anyway, to just keep your money separate.
And is it kind of like, so I know a lot of people who they keep their money separate, but they have a joint account for common spending.
Mm-hmm.
So like
that's a great strategy.
Yeah, they'll live together, right? So their IRAs and their other stuff, because then unwinding it for the different kids and different families, let's say it's a second or third marriage, later in life in particular, and now you have kind of joint expenses, right? Your house, your cable, your dining, your cars, your, you know, all those things, travel. So you have kind of each one of them push in, let's say, $3,000, $4,000 a month, whatever the number is, right, from their other assets into this pooled account, and therefore allowing them to utilize that for joint expenses. Is that?
Yes. So I've seen it done that way. I've seen a lot of people who are really reluctant to have any joint accounts, in which case they kind of just do a true accounting of what their expenses are and say, okay, well, since I'm going to pay, you know, the rent, for instance, if you pay the utilities and all of the groceries and our taxes, for instance, that'll kind of equal out. So let's just split the expenses more or less evenly.
So when is the time when it's, you should like never, ever merge your finances? So we talked about, okay, getting married and things of that nature and possibly unmarried, maybe doing it, maybe not doing it. When's the kind of time where you say, no, this isn't happening?
I would say as long as you have radically different money philosophies and mindsets, you shouldn't combine assets because it's just a cause of conflict. It's just another source of conflict, right? So if your main focus is preserving the relationship rather than, you know, growing money or anything like that, most people focus on the relationship and how in love they are. If you have a radically different belief about money and how it should be spent or saved or invested or any of that, like so completely different that there's no middle ground whatsoever, then I wouldn't combine finances.
I guess there's also those specific circumstances where, for example, you have maybe somebody with a spending problem or a gambling problem. You know, somebody's either sitting at home and buying stuff on Home Shopping Network or these days on the computer through Amazon, et cetera, and they just can't stop themselves. So we're talking about compulsive spending habits. Which really annoys and irks the other party, you know, that really the other party's like, oh, make yourself happy, do what you want. Or maybe somebody's gambling or doing some other things that are outside the norm of what would be acceptable for the other party, right? Would you say that if they were married and had their assets all merged, they should consider unmerging them?
Yes, I would separate. In the other instances that I was thinking along the lines of is when I mean radically different, like even simpler things, like I've met people who are like, you know, all I want to spend all of my money during my lifetime. I don't care if my kids get anything or grandkids. I don't care about leaving a legacy. I want to spend everything that I've made and I want to enjoy my life. And if that person's partner is, I want to spend as little as possible and I want to leave the majority of my assets to charity or to my kids or to my grandkids or whatever the case may be, that's a radically different view, period. So even in that case, you'd want to keep money separately and you'd want to figure out, you know, what your real budget is. And, you know, that is a cause for concern in the relationship when the views are that far apart.
I can remember two specific clients many years ago that was very similar, right? The husband was like, hey, you know what? You know what? We'll spend it. We'll do it. I'm not worried. And the wife said, you know what? I want to leave as much as I can to my kids. I mean, that's just very simply like you stated. So there was really no way to really wrestle through this problem. But what they ended up doing and we figured out was, hey, you know what? Let's buy a life insurance policy on the wife. And we brought in an agent. And we figured out, actually, it ended up being a survivorship life in this circumstance. But anyway, they pushed some money aside so that they could leave their entire estate at the value that it was at the time when they did this to their children. But at the same time, essentially spend all their assets down minus a little bit of money that went into the insurance on an annual basis.
Yeah, that's a great strategy. But, you know, the lifestyle is still different, right? If you're someone who says, I want to spend as little as possible versus someone who says, I want to spend everything I've made, all like, it doesn't really matter. I'm not concerned about leaving it behind. Those are lifestyle choice differences.
Right. Yeah, no, I got you.
So,
yeah, the problem comes right. also, right, because now all of a sudden you have somebody who likes that big bank account every day, all day, throughout their entire life. And the other one may be saying, right. well, you know what? We have 10 years to live. We have $750,000. We could spend $75,000 a year, and that's it. And but the problem is you get down to year nine, and all of a sudden there's only $150,000 left.
Right.
And now somebody's panicking.
Yep, absolutely. I always say death is a terrible financial plan.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
So
no kidding.
I'm sure you've also had clients like that, but you know, people who overspend their money. The reality is that the biggest risk most retirees face today is longevity risk, right? It's not that most people can live the next 10 years, but what if you live 15 years instead of the next 10? Like, there's a problem there, right? That, you know, you need to figure out a way to be conservative and enjoy your lifestyle at the same time.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, I've been doing this a little bit longer than you have, but I'll tell you what we started when I began in the business back in the 80s. The plan was very simple. The plan was figure out how old the client is, how much money they have. They're going to work till they're 60 or 65. They're going to retire, and then they're going to have a maximum of 10 years that they'll need their money from, because after that, they're just going to die. That was the plan.
Yep.
And it was okay, well, that makes sense. And fast forward just a few years, by the way, and all of a sudden you look back on that and you're like, oh, that's not going to work so well. And the reality is that as people are living longer due to healthy diets, due to medicines and technology of the healthcare systems, the fact is that you have to plan on living a while. There's nothing good about living past your money.
Yes. You want a lot of, you don't want a lot of years left at the end of your money.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well put. All right, let's kind of switch over here and talk about some of the different, the generational differences in investing right now, because we see a lot of that, whereas people right now who don't have jobs, young people that were getting some money on, unfortunately, this whole pandemic issue, they decided that, you know what, instead of saving this money, let's just invest it in the stock market. There was some recent studies that came out that showed that a lot of the money that was coming into many firms, particularly like a Robinhood, et cetera, were in the amounts of $300 and $600 deposits, which totally correlates to exactly the amount that was being paid by the federal government for the unemployment compensation during the time when there was that flowing, which it still is. So older generations, if they got that money, may have had a different thought of what they should be doing with that, because they didn't know when that was going to end. And quite frankly, this younger generation has never been in a time, while markets came down, but they've never been in a time that it wasn't easy money from the Fed, low interest rates, and stimulus by the government. So there's kind of a different mindset on where, one, the millennials who were given everything anyway and now getting even more from others, to maybe some of the older people out there that kind of had to make it on their own. I'm not judging. I'm just talking. I'm really not judging. I'm just saying what the mental philosophy is and of these parties. How are they dealing with planning, you know, differently?
Yeah, so I would actually say there's kind of two camps, even in the millennial group, right? So there's the camp like me. I started working in the financial industry just before the 08-09 pandemic. And for the millennials that graduated colleges in 2008, 2009, 2007 even, they have a distrust of traditional employment. And it's really, really evident in the way that we're investing, we're purchasing things. We're in the let's find alternative ways to produce income. It's also really evident in the Bitcoin craze, in how much money is flowing into real estate, non-commercial real estate, but residential real estate in certain areas. It's evident in how many different income streams millennials have found ways to create. Whereas I would say people who are in the older generation don't trust the alternative, right? So they've seen the crash of the real estate market. They've seen alternatives like bubbles, like Bitcoin in the early 2000s break, where the technology might be good, right? So there's the underlying technology of Bitcoin might be great, but it's like the underlying technology of the internet age when Netscape and AOL were there. Netscape and AOL are no longer around, but the internet is, right? So it's kind of like, how do you know what to invest in if you're going with crypto? So while the underlying technology might be around for a long time, we don't know what's going to happen to Bitcoin or Ether or anything else, but you had to have experience that age to know that. And so there's this sort of, you know, push towards, you know, more accountability for employers, making sure, you know, there's this big push on anyone who oversees a retirement plan being a fiduciary to make sure it's in the best interest. So it's all push, I think, from the older generation, much more so than the younger generation. I think there's this hunt for alternative sources of income in the millennial investment space that's really, really different from retirees who are actually turning more and more traditional. Mm-hmm. So that's really where I see the difference, much less so from like really thinking about getting free money from other places. I think it's much more that they're really concerned that the jobs won't be there when they need them. And so they're finding ways to not rely on needing a job.
But are they also combining that, and this is what I'm questioning, with the idea that, okay, if it's not going to be there, there'll always be a place like I could go run back to, whether it's, and I'm just giving you an example. This is not a criticism, but I could always go back to mom and dad's house. I mean, me growing up, I was out of my house when I was 18 or 19, and I never went back.
You and me both.
I was like, I'm not going back. Not that I didn't like them. It's just that I want to be on my own. I want to explore. I want to do. And no matter what I had to do, by the way, I would get the number of jobs that I needed in order to pay my rent. I mean, I used to, and I still do today because it's now ingrained. But anytime I got change in my pocket, I would save that change and never spend it. And I would put it in a little, you know, jar. And I would always have need for that at the end of the month to scramble around for a meal or to pay the rent or whatever it is. Now, actually, what I do now is I leave it wherever it is and let them just spend it. But that's another story. But the point is that is there a mental thought about, oh, you know, worst comes to worst, if I lose my job, I got that backup from the government, I'll get paid from someone else. I can, you know, I don't know. Is there a difference there? You know, like one thinks they have a backstop. I never thought I had a backstop.
Yeah. So I think millennials, I would say, are a little bit more open to the idea that our government will create, especially over time, the social safety nets that would be helpful for people who lose their jobs and things like that. I think there's definitely some of that. You know, millennials statistically tend to be a little more liberal, and that kind of relates to that. I think also related to it, because older people have seen a huge turnover in government and how much the pendulum can swing, you know, every 4 years or so, and in some places even every two years, there is a distrust of government, which would make you really want to be able to make sure you never had to rely on the government.
Yeah. So there's a lot right? less, there's probably a lot less bunker mentality with millennials than with some of the older folks. Maybe.
Yeah. I would say that, you know, it's not so much, you know, I can run back to mom and dad's house. It's I can't trust employers. I have to be able to trust my government. The government has to step in because employers are going unwatched and all these companies are doing all these terrible things. This is just, you know, we're getting really stereotypical here. But, you know, some of the things that I've heard on, you know, around is just, you know, there's a distrust of employees. We need the employers. We need the government to step in. Pensions are cut. Pell grants are cut. Student loan debt is higher than ever. It's like somebody has to help us. Otherwise, there's no way out.
Right.
And if you think back to, you know, in the early 90s, where, you know, you could buy a house, a decent house, even in New York City, you can buy a decent apartment for something like $50,000 or $60,000, those same apartments, even though employer, you know, wages haven't gone up, that's commiserate, you know, that matches that, those same apartments are now 1.2, 1.5 million.
Not for long. New York City, not
maybe.
For long.
And And then you have student loan debt that you're coming out of college with a psychology degree with student loan debt of $400,000, earning $60,000 per year, being a student counselor somewhere. I mean, how do you get ahead?
Yeah.
Right. And it's sort of just how, like, what else is there to support you if your pension plan is gone? You've spent your whole entire life, what would have gone to savings or putting towards real estate or a home or something like that, has gone to student loan debt or just keeping up with your obligations because wages have not kept pace with all the other things as they've gotten more expensive.
You know, it's interesting. You know, what you talk about there is that there's an interesting aspect to this because years ago, there was defined benefit plans, right? And you would, yeah. You know, you'd have this thing where I'm going to work 20 years or 30 years, whatever it was. And when I come out of this job, I'm going to have X amount of salary, 80% of my salary for the rest of my life guaranteed with a COLA, cost of living adjustment. Now there's not that, you know, they cut that, which was very helpful for the companies. You know, you look at a company like a GM and a Ford, what's the difference between them and a Tesla? Well, one of the big differences, there's no pension obligation that Tesla has like a Ford or a GM or a Chrysler. And that's a big drag on companies' profitability. And they cut that. And now they have 401ks, which you're responsible essentially to provide your own retirement for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And even before, even if you graduated with student loan debt and you spent your entire 30-year career paying it off, you still had that pension plan to fall back on to live.
Right.
Now you have to do everything and take care of it all yourself. It's really an interesting place where we start to think about, you know, how much, you know, all of the debt issues in this country are really costing, you know, the younger generation.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, when I had that pension, the defined benefit plan, which gave me a money amount per year, that was guaranteed. That was the number, unless the company went out of business, but that was guaranteed. Now I have a 401k. And even if I have X amount of millions in it, I don't know exactly what's going to happen with the investments to give me a long-term guarantee of what I can actually take out of it. It's all variable. It's kind of scary.
Yeah.
It's pretty scary. I mean, in terms of the personal responsibility that's now put upon people to really plan the rest of their lives, which I'm not really against because it can be done. I've seen it being done, you know, hundreds of times.
Right.
But it is a big differential in terms of your mentality of when you're working and what you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. And it's also what's keeping people working longer than ever. You know, there's so many different safety nets that are called under question. We don't know what's going to happen to Social Security, right?
Like,
so everyone in their 30s is paying into it, but I don't know if it's going to be there when I'm 70. Chances are it's going to be at least haircut as life expectancy grows. So there's so many different components to it that are emotionally driven, security driven, certainty driven. I mean, if you're graduating college these days, you don't know if Social Security is going to be there. You don't know. You don't have a pension. You don't know how much your student loan debt is, if it's going to be forgiven or how much of it, or if it's going to actually inflate. You don't know how much housing is going to cost long term. You don't know what's going to happen to the stock market. I mean, the uncertainty is literally endless.
And it's paralyzing. No wonder, by the way, this answers the question. No wonder why millennials don't want to leave home. I mean, why go out into this big, scary place out there with all these unknowns if I can just go into the refrigerator and know that it's always going to be stocked by mom and dad? Seriously. I mean, I have kids. I have a kid that was just living at home, you know, who's in his mid-20s, you know, after he kind of is moving around. He was there for a little while. But I get it. I totally get it, you know, but that's great. Listen, I appreciate you spending some time with us today. Veronica Karas, we're going to have information on where you can find out more information. And of course, you can get her books on Amazon and wherever other fine books are sold, as well as on Audible as an audiobook as well. For that, again, it's Money Matters, Everything You Should Have Learned in School But Didn't, and that's part of a series. So check that out, and we're going to have it all on episode number 693 of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can find it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a great rest of your day.
All right, you too.
Bye.
Once again, plenty of information, plenty of deep stuff to talk about and things that maybe you haven't thought about. And it's like, oh, that's ringing my bell right there. And maybe I can do something with that to figure out how to set myself up a little bit better. You know, we don't always talk about investments only on this show. And obviously, there's some other aspects of the world of finance that you need to pay attention to. So Veronica did a good job with those things that I threw out her. All right, so I got some questions that came in. Some of these are kind of lengthy in their comments, but I'll get through them real quickly and maybe I'll abbreviate some. First one's from James. James writes, hey, thanks for all the great information over the years. I've been listening to you, and when you talk about your Quanta Tech, the funda philosophy over the years for stock analysis, but the bulk of my current savings for retirement is in a 401k. What strategy would you use to decide how to allocate funds when you have limited choices and limited information? FYI, our options include target funds with index, small, mid, blend, large, foreign, et cetera, and some active funds and our company stock, et cetera. Also, since these are only for retirement accounts, you don't have tickers, which makes it very hard to research. Thanks for looking forward to sending my retirement money to you eventually. Hey, thanks, James. This is really interesting because, you know, you're dead on. Because you're dead on with the idea that, you know, you get these 401ks, it's supposed to be transparent and all that, and they have these funds in there that have these weird symbols, but the names seem to be the same. Oftentimes, here's what to do, what you want to think about. Look at the fund, and then you could even call the company and ask, what particular mutual fund does this really mimic? Because oftentimes, they're what we call clones. There may be a different fee structure, slightly different holdings, but generally speaking, many of the 401k funds that are in the offerings are clones of the funds that are actually out there that you can do the research on. So one of the things that we do on a regular basis when we're reviewing portfolios like this, just like what you're talking about here, is number one, we'll figure out what actual underlying fund is similar in investments or identical cloned and fee structure, number one. Number two, if it's not there, if we can't find anything, what we'll do is we'll look at, okay, what is the particular sector that it represents? So let's make it kind of easy. Let's call it the ABC Small Cap Value Fund is the investment that you want to look at. And you cannot find anything about that. Well, what we'll do is we'll look at, for example, the sector that it represents, which is the small cap value, U.S., domestic. And then what we'll do is we'll put a proxy of that ETF into the portfolio when we're constructing it to see how that lays out overall. Does that make sense? Now, the problem is you may not have a choice of multitude of different funds within the 401k. It's like, okay, here's your small cap value fund, and you don't know if that's the best or the worst. Frankly, you don't have a choice because that's your choice. If you want to be in that sector, that's the fund. It could be good. It could be high price. It could be low price. It could be terrible. Management's good. Management's bad. Fact is, you can only do what you can do within your 401k. One of the things you may want to look at is to see if you could take an in-service distribution. Some funds, firms allow you to do that. We've done that for people, and then we can invest in an IRA and then have all the choices that we want. Or see if they have not an in-service distribution that you could do, but if they have an alternative where you can have a self-directed 401k. And if you have that option, you may be able to invest in a lot of things outside of there. Otherwise, sorry, you know this, James, when you wrote this, you're kind of stuck. Unfortunately, you're stuck with what they have to offer, and do your best to come up with a some kind of proxy for it to figure it out. But you can usually call up the custodian and ask, hey, I need a list of funds that these are clones of. Next question comes in from Stephen G, and he says, hey, Mr. Horowitz, I hope all is well. You often speak of software to improve enhanced research, charting and order execution. Most, if not all, are Windows-only applications. And without running Windows on a virtual machine, what should Macintosh users do? The online brokers like Schwab and ET, E-Trade, TD Ameritrade often have browser-based online research charts that Mac users can access. Fidelity also has their ActiveTrader Pro that does run on Mac. So far, it's the only one I've used. What other thoughts do you have, et cetera? Well, I mean, listen, I'm not just saying this because we have this being sponsored by them. Interactive Brokers has a Mac version also. I think there's something to be said if you're trying to do pure charting that you may want to run a virtual machine and run a Windows emulation somehow. But yes, many of these are created for simply Windows. Now, it all depends on what you're doing. If you're doing charting, there's TradingView also. If you want a full suite of research, I would check out Interactive Brokers. And the links are on the site too for that. But other than that, I mean, you know, it depends on what you're trying to do. You can cobble together a variety of different sites, maybe not an all-in-one with a Mac, and try to do all your research that way as well. A couple more questions. Peter writes, hey, Andrew, why would I not use a credit line mortgage at about 2% interest and buy this particular stock, which is yielding about 11%? I know not to be fooled by yield, but this one looks pretty safe. And how do I explain to my wife that it's better not to pay down the mortgage, currently locked in at 1.69%, and use that, quote, extra money for investment? Thanks for the show. Still learning a lot from you. Peter, yeah, I would say that low rates, first of all, I'm a big believer of having a mortgage if the rates are really low. There's no reason to pay off a mortgage if you can get free money or cheap money under 2% or 2% or so. Take that money and do something with it. If nothing else, you know what? Buy some very, very, very conservative interest bearing. You have access to the money. If it's buried inside the house, you're not going to make any more or less on the valuation increase of the house over the years. It's going to be whatever it is. So burying the house, the money inside of a mortgage, which would be very difficult to get to refinance at times, if nothing else, if you don't have a credit line that's already set up, it could take months. And if you ever need access to that money, it makes it very difficult to do. So I'm a big believer in when interest rates are very low that, yeah, you have this opportunity. But at the same time, you know, I got to put these flashing red lights right now, and I'm being very serious when I tell you that when you think about a company that yields 10 or 11%, which may be a good company, I'm not saying anything about the company, realize that, you know what, you can have underlying principal erosion due to the fact that maybe the underlying stock is not doing so well. Now, the one you're talking about is kind of an oil-related and a limited partnership, master limited partnership, and those are interesting. But, you know, if you ever see a collapse in oil, these things can go down 20% pretty darn easily, and then what? Now, you say, well, I still get the 11%. What if they cut their dividend for some reason? Just saying. These are the things you need to ask yourself if you're willing to take the risk. The red warning lights that I'm telling you about is this, that, you know what, you really don't want to try to arbitrage your house to buy an investment that may be a problem. You know, if you come down on that and all of a sudden you get some kind of, you know, need for money and you don't have access to it and now you have a mortgage, yeah, you can pay it off. It'll just take you a longer period of time, but don't be too aggressive with that money. I like to have that emergency fund always 6 months or so of your salary in kind of a very readily available, low bearing, we'll call it right now, account that you can have access to, that easy access that you can just grab the money whenever you want. Other than that, if you want to start going above that and thinking about looking at this as an investment opportunity, that's up to you. As far as what I'm telling your wife, listen, you got to do this together. We just talked to a guest that talked about making decisions together. And that discussion, hopefully you listened to, Peter, because that was in there that some are more conservative, some are more aggressive. You may want to take a middle ground of that and maybe think about keeping the mortgage but paying off a little bit faster to satisfy her need and desire to pay that off and your desire to invest. Last question comes in from Scott. And we'll hold Jason for next. Scott, he says, hey, I always hear people said rolling options to the next month. How do I do that? Please provide details as I often lose 100% in call options. Can't really sell anything nowadays because it keeps on ripping higher the markets, but where do all these monies come from? Which is what we just answered. And where else, what's the plan about profit taking besides 1 foot in and 1 foot out? Do you set 10 to 20% stop limits? So something that I think is really important, we do have stop limits. One of the things that I look for when we're investing in equity is a change in the dynamic movement of the price that is based on some pretty advanced logic with regard to volume and price. This is a way of looking at it. And when we look at this, you know, you have to look at market auction market theory and market profile. And, okay, I utilize that for my stops or my entries, et cetera. In terms of, let's just focus on this one item here, which is this item about, you know, rolling options. All you have to do is start buying the future months. One of the things that I would recommend to you is if you're doing some work in options, always go out a couple of months longer possibly than you think is the time. If you're losing, I would venture to say there's been like, If I would have held it just a little while longer, I bet some of those times you would have made some money. So always go out on the date into the future to find out maybe there's a better opportunity a little bit longer, because sometimes markets can stay a little bit irrational, a little bit, just a small amount, longer than you can stay solvent. And that's like, seems like what's going on with you right here, my friend. So Jason, who was that one from? Wait, let's see that one. That one was from, that wasn't Jason. Jason will hold him for next week. That was Scott. Scott L. Scott, think about moving again along the range outward on that. Listen, I want to wish everybody a wonderful, wonderful Christmas, a happy holiday. Whatever you are celebrating, I wish you the very, very best. You can always get in touch with me over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'm going to see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.